Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the LA Steel Show. I'm Lila.
I gotta say, I love how you do that. She's so perfectly timed that the second comes on. It's just amazing.
Give our show greetings.
Just amazing. I'm so impressed all the time. Always impressed. Anyway, we're happy to be here tonight, and had a good show last night. We're going to be replaying our interview with Larry Dorman, the public affairs coordinator of the AFSCME union,
right,
which is affiliated with the AFL-CIO. But we talked about Attorney General Blumenthal's bid for Chris Dodd's Senate seat.
This is in Connecticut. And we talked a little bit about others in the party who are running for office.
Yeah, yeah.
We have a little difference of opinion there, how we feel about certain people.
And then,
we put him on the spot a little bit.
Yeah. Well, Larry's a good guy.
He's a real nice guy.
He let us do that, and we appreciate the guy a lot. And we appreciate AFSCME Union. But I wanted to say... But we also talk about the AFL-CIO stance against Obama's health care bill, the way that it's written right now, and taxes on health care benefits. So we're going to be talking about that tonight. But in the meantime, that'll be coming up at about 8:30 or so. So in the meantime, we've got a couple of things.
Give you a little news.
Yeah.
Michelle Bachmann warns financial bill worse than the health care measure. A Republican congressman who has been in the forefront of the fight against the health care bill, the climate control bill, and other contentious measures warned in an impromptu interview on the Brett Bart TV Thursday evening that a fast-tracked, under-the-radar mega bill by Representative Barney Frank of Massachusetts, designed to overhaul the regulation of the entire financial services industry and headed at the time for passage by the House, is even worse. I know that's hard to believe, but it's worse in the sense that every American makes financial transactions, said Michelle Bachmann, who represents the people of Minnesota's 6th Congressional District. We all use credit cards. We all write checks. This will all now be controlled by government, and government will ration credit. You can't have capitalism without capital, and government will decide who gets capital and who doesn't. The entirety of this bill, all pinned together like this, hasn't even gone through committees, Bachmann said. It just went onto the floor for 3 hours of debate. It's a complete government control of the financial services, and no one knows about it. So hopefully we'll be hearing more about that. I hope people are going to...
Yeah, I think so.
Right now, people are all wrapped up in the health care bill, but she thinks this is even worse.
What's coming next?
I'm not exactly sure what she means, though, by...
I was a little vague on that myself, because she's been known to go overboard
on things when she complains about them.
Yeah.
She says we will all, and write checks, and will all now be controlled by the government, and the government will ration credit. She doesn't explain what she means by that. I mean, she's sending up an alarm and a red flag and all that, but she really hasn't defined what she means by her complaints. They're too general.
Mm.
So I would like to find out more.
That's what I felt, too. But I thought it was important to bring up, because the first I heard about that.
Hmm.
You know what I mean? And
she maybe has a website or something. We should go to that.
Alex has the...
it's from InfoWars.
Yeah, he pulls stuff like that up. He thought that was interesting enough, too, that... he wanted to look into it more, but
we should find out more about that.
Yeah.
Just exactly what she means and what this bill is. So, if you don't hear us talk about it, go to your own computer and look it up and see what's out there about this financial bill, because apparently people think it's worse than the health care bill, which as it reads right now, in my mind, has significant problems. I mean, I was basically for a single-payer health care. I also wanted all Americans insured, and I also didn't want it done on the backs of the middle class, so I'm against the excise tax. And I think people paying over $1 million should be taxed a little more than everybody else. If your household has $1 million income, I think you could afford to be taxed a little more. I think I believe health care is a right.
I gotta ask, you pulled this up last night, and I don't know how many Connecticut listeners we got, but I think it should be noted just for the record. This letter here, this letter by Lowell P. Weicker Jr.
It made me sick. That's why I pulled it up.
This used to be. This is from the Current, the Hartford Current, and you can get it on current.com in Connecticut. But for those of you who are interested in the Chris Dodd affair, all right, we suddenly have another notorious Republican turned independent governor. You remember that, Lila?
Oh yeah.
This guy was a real piece of work.
Oh, he made all kinds of campaign promises.
He was the guy that got
turned around.
What he did is he allowed the casinos in Connecticut, and so that they could pick up the taxes on the.
And then he immediately moved to somewhere else, to Maryland or Virginia.
Yeah, well, what he did is
he crammed it all down the throats of.
Yeah, because he was kicked out of office by the voters. Not only by the voters. I mean, there was a huge rally. Huge rally, and I attended.
He was hated when he left.
Went back in those days. I used to be a real estate broker, and what he was doing, he had in New Britain, Connecticut. They had this huge rally against him, and I went down there. Actually, I got noted in the paper. I interviewed in the paper for it, and the reason I mentioned it is because what he did was create the total incredible craziness in the state. Putting all kinds of taxes and stuff, and he's an independent. Yeah, of course.
Well, I just heard a dog bark outside. Sorry,
and
folks.
And he was an independent, all right.
Yeah.
Just like Joe Lieberman, he was a Republican and turned independent, ran for governor and won. The same thing happened with Joe Lieberman. He was a Democrat, got kicked out of his party, became an independent and won his. His Senate seat back. So the reason I'm bringing this up is this is to give you a little background on this guy. And Lowell Weicker, for those of you who may or may not remember, he became a senator, and he was our senator in 1972. And I don't know if Chris Dodd was there at that time.
No. Chris Dodd got his seat.
That's right, Chris Dodd got his seat, but the incestuous nature of that is that he beat out his father.
Right.
Lowell Weicker actually beat out Chris Dodd's father.
When he had to leave because of corruption.
Yeah.
They don't mention that.
It's just
that.
Funny that his son winds up leaving for the same reason.
Yeah, well, criminality runs.
But here's the guy that held his seat in the meantime and presided over the Watergate hearings. All right, Lowell Weicker, remember him?
Yeah, he made a reputation for himself there.
Yeah, he did.
But then he turned around and he screwed
Connecticut. Yeah, and he's also a pharmaceutical...
Squib.
Yeah, he's a...
extremely wealthy.
What is he? The,
he was the heir to...
Trust boy, yeah, the trust fund boy of Squib Pharmaceutical.
He was the heir to the Squib fortune.
So this is the guy. This is where we're coming from here as a reference letter for Chris Dodd. Okay? Lowell V. Weicker Jr., sharp contrast to the ankle-biting midgets. January 10th, 2010, Harper Current. What a great career and what a fine man. That's my opinion of Senator Chris Dodd. Our lives have been intertwined since the day I defeated his dad in 1970 and then went on to serve with Chris for many years in the Senate. I stay in close touch with the politics of my state and so have heard the negative swirling around Chris for the past year. Right. Some might have basis in fact. Others are speculative excess. All I know is that 30 years of committed, sensitive public service on behalf of the people of Connecticut eclipse any missteps bandied about by his distractors. This is a man who made a career in helping our working families, the frail, the infirm. This is a man who is leading the charge for access to decent health care. This is a man who has opposed the disastrous armed intervention that have marked U.S. foreign policy over the past decade. This is a man who, entering politics, worked with the poor and neglected abroad. Always a gentleman, on and off the floor of the Senate, Chris stands in sharp contrast to the ankle-biting midgets who populate today's politics. I'm proud of Christopher Dodd and wish him and his family happiness and good fortune. The country will miss him. Bull P. Weicker, Jr. was the governor of Connecticut from 1991 to 1995 and a U.S. senator from 1971 to 1988. Amazing, huh?
Yeah.
And then that's when he got out, and he got out of the Senate, then came into the Connecticut for real and screwed the state off, state over royal. That was about that time. That's right. That was just about then, 1988, 21. Yeah, won the governorship.
And he's not missed either.
Not at all. Nobody talks about it. He poked his head in somewhere, oftentimes around the time of the governor or election time or something. You'll see something in the Hartford Current. But that's about it.
But he doesn't live here anymore.
Doesn't he? They don't have his address in here.
I don't think so. I thought he moved to Virginia.
Or Maryland or some crazy place. Yeah, we got a few more minutes. Let's see. Did we? Yeah, we wrote that one. About Geithner. You wrote that.
Yeah.
Let's see if there's anything else. I know we didn't read a lot of stuff. This was an. I don't know if you'd like to read that. Is that too small?
Might be too small. I can't read print. It's too small.
Okay.
Oh, no, I can't even see it.
That's okay.
I'd have that. To hold it way over there.
We'll do that and see if you can. This one you like, I'll read this one. Let's see. Okay, yes. So this is an article by New American Media. And it says, did court deal fatal blow to tasers for police? This is regarding a ruling that ruled against policemen's use of tasers. I'll get to it right now. In what is being heralded as a landmark decision, the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit recently declared that police officers could be held liable for using a taser without proper cause. And in making their determination, the court also set new legal parameters on how law enforcement is to use tasers, stating, the objective facts that indicate that the suspect poses an immediate threat to the officer or a member of the public, the federal finding substantially changes the landscape of taser usage and may single the end of tasers for law enforcement agencies who are now more vulnerable to civil and criminal actions than ever before. That's good. That's good. What do you think? I think they should get those damn things out of there. You know, these are buzz toys that just, you know, horrible torture.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. The decision, which has already caused law enforcement agencies to reevaluate their taser policies, stems from the case involving a Coronado police officer, Brian McPherson, who tased unarmed 21-year-old Brian, during a traffic stop for a seatbelt infraction in South Carolina. After being pulled over, Brian was standing outside of his vehicle wearing only boxer shorts and tennis shoes. He was 20 to 50 feet from the officer, and when tased, fell face down to the ground fractured four teeth and had to get the taser prongs removed from his scalp. Ouch. Brian went on to sue the Coronado Police Department, and the federal appellate court was making a determination if McPherson had immunity to the lawsuit as an officer. The court ruled in favor of Brian. So Brian won.
The victim won.
Right. And
he rightly so.
And while any regulation or taser use is a move forward from the status quo, which repeatedly has left civilians tased for innocuous circumstances, and the decision acknowledges some of the inherent dangers of the weapon, it falls short in a most critical way. The instruction is based on a false premise that tasers fall into the category of non-lethal force, as stated in Judge Wardlaw's written opinion. By denying the lethality of tasers, the court mistakenly treats tasers as an intermediary weapon, like a baton, when it should be treated as a deadly weapon, like a firearm. According to Amnesty International, there have been more than 350 deaths due to tasers. In San Jose, such was the first city to arm every one of its officers with a weapon in 2004, and there have been 6 taser-involved deaths, more than a death a year since its inception. And currently, the city is facing a $20 million lawsuit from the family of one of the more recent victims, Steven Salinas. The unarmed Salinas was tased to death in his motel room in 2007. Like Brian, Salinas' ultimate tasing originated from a minor starting point, and police were called to the scene due to allegedly loud noises emanating from the room, and Salinas, who was naked at the time, died in the room shortly after the police arrived. They must have been having sex, you know. And the growing body count attributed to tasers refutes the commonly accepted advertisement from its leading manufacturer, Taser International, that tasers are a non-lethal option for officers. Furthermore, the unreliability of the weapon to bring down its target makes it dangerous even for officers who may be in a situation requiring deadly force. According to a San Jose Mercury News study of the San Jose Police Department use of tasers in 2007, tasers in a dart mode are only effective 70% of the time in bringing down their target, and in stun mode only 60% of the time. So it's not an effective weapon, really.
No
more than a quarter of the time, or three-quarters
of the time. And then the other rest of the time, you can kill somebody for a minor act.
No, it's like having a gun with 6 shots, you know what I mean? And only 4 work. You know what I mean? Cool. Excuse me one second.
Leo's having trouble with his
stuff.
Yeah. Hang on. Yeah. I have to check his tape.
Yeah.
It'll come to the end of its
roll
or whatever you call that there.
Yeah.
The thing that I don't like about tasers is it's supposed to be a non-lethal way to get people to comply, but many people have died from it, and I don't think you should die as a result of a minor traffic act in transgression or, you know, something very minor shouldn't end up having a lethal kind of interference.
Websites. Well, the fall is clearly ahead in every...
So, anyway, let me read this while Leo plays with
it. Yeah, I'm sorry I had to do that, folks. I didn't mean to.
Okay. So, this is from naturalnews.com, and I didn't get a chance to look at this last night, but global deep freeze threatens 2010 food supply. The global deep freeze now striking North America, Europe, China, and other regions may lead to severe food shortages and price hikes throughout 2010. Right now, rare freezing temperatures are destroying root crops in their ground, wiping out citrus orchards, and devastating food producers around the world. The upshot of it all? Expect food shortages and rising food prices through 2010. The global deep freeze is all part of the extreme weather now being unleashed on the planet due to human beings polluting the world and altering the atmosphere. That's what this group thinks. Scientists can't agree on whether the trend is global warming or global cooling. They also can't decide whether it's a naturally occurring phenomena that weather changes, and it's not our fault. But no one can argue that there's something wrong with the weather. So we don't know why, but there is something wrong with it, they're saying. Rainfall and temperature patterns that used to be reliable are now going haywire. Where there were once reliable seasonal rains, there are alternating periods of droughts followed by floods. Where temperatures were once mild and predictable, they're now fluctuating out of control, becoming too hot in the summer and too cold in the winter. And this adds up to escalating crop failures that are now poised to have real, noticeable impact on the global food supply. Sub-zero temperatures have made it impossible to extract some vegetables from the ground. Producers of Brussels sprouts and cabbages are all reporting problems with harvesting. Cauliflowers are said to have turned to mush in the sustained frost. excuse me, says a story published in The Guardian, which is a British newspaper. It goes on to report, in Ireland, 6,000 acres of potatoes remain unharvested, and there are claims that up to three-quarters of the crop may be ruined. Potato growers in Northern Ireland say they are facing some of the biggest losses in recent history because of the frost damage. The UK Press Association also reports food shortages are feared as it emerged that farmers are struggling to harvest vegetables in the big freeze, which will lead to higher food prices and damage small businesses. News is also surfacing that the world's orange juice supply may be destroyed. Growers in the Sunshine State fear an even worse Arctic blast Sunday night, that was last week, will decimate their crop, which accounts for 40% of the world's orange juice supply. All this destruction of food is already causing prices to rise. Greengrocers in some of the worst-hit areas are reporting shortages, with the price of carrots and parsnips reportedly rising by 30% in some small shops, reports The Guardian. Similar reports are also coming out of China, which has been hard hit by freezing weather. The global deep freeze, now devastating crops around the world, leads to one inescapable conclusion. Food prices will rise throughout 2010. They were already on the rise in 2009, but thanks to the big winter deep cold and deep freeze, it threatens the 2010 food supply. There may be much more than a one-time crisis, too. For years, academics such as Ting Lang, professor of food policy at City University, gave warning that we were sleepwalking into a future where our food security was likely to be seriously undermined, whether by natural disasters, rising food costs, climate change, or the massive pressures placed on the global food supply by rising population. The fact is that plentiful food depends on cheap oil, fossil water aquifers, and predictable weather, and all three are coming to an end. Unpredictable and weather, in particular, is upon us right now. In the years ahead, radical weather patterns will continue to compromise food production around the world. Floods, freezes, hurricanes, droughts will take their toll. The result will be an increased food prices and decreased food supply. During the crises, many people will be forced to turn to low-cost processed foods that will further promote diseases like obesity, cancer, and heart disease. Fewer and fewer citizens of the world will be able to afford fresh, organic produce because it is precisely the fresh produce that's more easily destroyed by radical weather events. This means, of course, that food-producing land will greatly increase in value, especially if it can produce food year-round, and that means people who own such parcels of land in Hawaii, California, southern France, Mexico, or even places like Purdue or Ecuador will find their properties steadily increasing in value. Whatever fresh food can be reliably produced in the years ahead, properties will tend to increase in value. Like in areas hit by droughts, floods, or fossil water shortages, on the other hand, will collapse in value. Some areas that used to be fertile farmland will turn into desert.
Others will suffer severe soil erosion.
Yep.
From unpredictable weather events. Want to finish?
No, go ahead.
Okay. The era of easy food is over. Since the 1940s, we've lived in an age of easy food, but that food bubble is now collapsing. And as it does, it's going to catch most people off guard. Mm-hmm. Some will be able to compensate by simply paying much higher prices for the fresh food they need. Most people will not be able to afford to pay much more for food, so they'll turn to processed, long shelf life food instead, and before long, they will join the ranks of the diseased as a result. And remember, living food keeps you alive. Dead food makes you dead. The more fresh, living food you consume, the healthier you are, the healthier you will be. Sadly, our interference with the global climate is resulting in radical weather patterns that are destroying huge quantities of fresh produce, greatly reducing the supply of living food. And the alternative for individuals or families is to grow their own food. Grow as much as you can in your own gardens. And food security is the issue of the decade. I believe, and those who don't have the ability to grow at least some portion of their own diet may find themselves in an increasingly difficult position in 2010 and beyond. And Larry and I are building a garden this year.
Yeah, definitely.
I think we do. Yeah, we're going to have a little, 4x8?
Yeah, raised bed,
A 4x8 raised bed. I'm going to be putting
we're going to start with that anyway and see what happens.
Oh, we're going to get a topsy-turvy this year. I think we're going to get one.
We were looking at those for growing tomatoes upside down. They had a great ad on TV. You could buy it. We always thought,
we
could
have bought it for $5, I think, at CVS this morning.
No, it was more than that.
No, it wasn't much more. No, it was only $12.99, I think, on the television.
Uh-huh.
And I knew we should have got one, but and stored it. But it's cool. But we're gonna have the tomato grower, the topsy turvy tomato grower, and then we're gonna have I think peppers.
Raised
bed. We'll have some bell peppers, right?
Yep.
That'd be good. And
tomatoes, summer squash,
onions. Oh no, maybe not onions. Maybe onions. I don't know.
Whatever grows nicely, they will have to figure out.
I'll tell you, the onions we've been getting lately haven't been good. They're like old. You know, even though they're fresh, so there's something wrong with the onions patch.
They've been hanging around.
Yeah. Or there might be, but anyway. It's a long, hard winter, and a lot of areas have been flooded this year.
That's right.
And everything, so it's citrus is in or not citrus, but everything.
Vegetables.
Yeah, so it's going to be rough. But, you know, we're growing our victory garden here up in Connecticut. So
and I hope you guys at home do the same thing. You think about it, too.
I think
that's a good warning. You should have your own small vegetable plot. If you live in the city, you can have pots on a terrace or hanging baskets.
I like those little red hot peppers, too. We grew those one year, remember that?
Uh-huh.
They were very good, yeah. You can grow them in pots, you know, and you grow a lot of this stuff right in pots if you can't have the... But it's well worth it. Even though we got one cucumber last year.
that wasn't a good year for that.
There was so much rain.
There was so much rain we really couldn't grow anything.
Summer,
everything got washed away.
So
we had like 2 weeks of sunshine. That was about it. But anyway, we're moving toward the half past of the hour, and we're going to bring you our interview with Larry Dorman.
Yep.
Larry is the Public Affairs Coordinator for AFSCME. Council 4, that's AFSCME, American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees Union in Connecticut.
There you go.
He's a knowledgeable guy, and he's going to talk to us about union stuff.
And you've heard of him before. If you listen to our show, we have him on usually once a month. But let's go here. Don't be afraid. Don't be alarmed. The first minute of this is maybe 30 seconds of this tape where it didn't copy, so hopefully everything will work out. About a half an hour.
Straw poll that's going on, so I think this was a smart and decent move by Senator Dodd. I think it's my only regret, if you want to call it that, because I'm very pleased about Mr. Blumenthal's intentions, but he has been a terrific Attorney General, and I hope your listeners appreciate what he's meant to the state in terms of his willingness to fight corporations, fight for the little guy, take stands that weren't always popular, and I think he will be greatly missed in the state's Attorney General office, but this is a smart move by everyone.
I have to say, though, I agree with you on some of the things about Blumenthal, but I have a couple of really serious reservations about him myself. I agree with what you said and why you support him and perhaps why the union is supporting him, but I have to disagree with his treatment of the Scaticote Indian tribe, and I felt that was a bad stand on his part, and I couldn't support what he did in preventing them to have their recognition. They were recognized as a tribe officially, and then their recognition was pulled from them. And that was kind of like an insider job, which involved actually John McCain, who was part of that whole thing.
Chairman of the BIA.
Nancy Johnson. and
Governor Rell
and Attorney Blumenthal. And I was not happy how he handled that situation.
That's fair. You know, that's fair. And look, there, everybody we talk about is going to have some flaws and some actions that we disagree with. And so I know exactly where you're coming from. I think on balance, though, that he's been very good. And, you know, the only thing I'll say, and again, I don't mean to pretend to be an expert on that, but in terms of the shadow code recognition, you know, oftentimes the attorney general is forced to defend the state's action. Obviously,
that's true.
He's the chief lawyer, so to speak, for the state of Connecticut. So, and I'm wondering if that might have been the case where he had nowhere else to go. I don't profess to be expert on that.
I've got serious issue on that. But
and I just think that so many of our public officials are just coming from different vantage points when it comes to recognition of federal Indian tribes. I think that. I think by and large the government has just done a horrific job anyway of addressing Native Americans. So at this point, I guess what I'm saying is I'm not going to necessarily hold that against the Attorney General, but I absolutely respect what you're saying.
Good. I'm glad you said that because I feel it's really important the way Indigenous peoples have been treated in our own country.
The treatment of Indigenous peoples is horrific. It's a massacre, and I just don't know. And it's kind of created some of the public, and it's led to these public policy dilemmas that we're faced with when it comes down to casinos and recognizing tribes.
But they had a 200-year recognition by the state of Connecticut and a reservation. And then, and that was being—that's virtually been annihilated now. And
I'm sure that there was pressure somehow from other tribal nations.
I'm sure there were as well.
Led to that reversal. So, the whole thing is, quite frankly, been.
I think it's an embarrassment to the state of Connecticut.
Public policy when it comes to the treatment. So that probably sounds like a cop-out on my end, but I do also believe that there are moments, including our lawsuit, the state employees sued Governor Rowland for the alleging that the layoffs in 2002-2003 were illegal, which is being borne out in a very arduous court case. That's another example where the Attorney General really had his, he's handcuffed by the fact that he's got to represent the state, at best just simply kind of stay out of it while, the drama plays out between Rowland and the state, former Governor Rowland and the state employee. So that might have contributed to what happened. I don't know. Overall I was going through many of my clippings and so on and so forth about the Attorney General, and he really, during the Rowland era, distinguished himself in calling out the governor on corrupt contracting deals that ripped off taxpayers, ripped off workers. He most recently was at a press conference last week, and he's been putting public pressure on AT&T's treatment of consumers and workers there, the unionized workers at AT&T. He's taken on Pratt and Whitney, trying to stop them from destroying 1,000 middle-class family-supporting jobs. So, on balance...
you're right. Yeah, he's doing his job. But let's go on to... what's the thing? I wanted to change the subject a bit because I wanted to talk about the significance of the AFL-CIO. The president gave us a talk tonight, or he was on the news tonight, national news, regarding the Obama health care plan.
Yep.
And the horrid situation it's in, and that the unions, we're not going to support him on this. The way that it is now.
How did you take that, Larry?
How did you?
Sorry.
What did you think about that? About it.
Clarify the union stance on this.
Yeah. Well, what happened, just so your listeners know, the president did meet with a group of union leaders headed by the AFL-CIO and its president, Rich Trumka, and the labor movement very much opposes the portions of the health care reform,
initiative that the president generated, and that has now resulted in essentially two bills, a House bill and a Senate bill.
Mm-hmm.
And the president supports, there are two really major flaws that we see in what the president and the U.S. Senate are pushing. And that would be what's called an excise tax on higher-end plans, such as what unions negotiate for their members, and also the negative characteristic is the absence of a public option to provide competition and accountability for the private insurance industry that just keeps jacking up rates, jacking up their premiums and rates, enjoying record profits, and paying their executives millions and millions of dollars. So the Senate bill is without the public option, but does have the excise tax. The president favors the excise tax. So,
but the isn't this tax on health plans that are? I don't really know what a Cadillac health plan is. Do you?
I hate the phrase.
I do too, but I don't even know what it is. I mean, what is it? Anything over
a certain amount of money?
It's. I don't like using the word. What's going on here essentially is that the president and the Senate are proposing to tax benefits. They're calling them on high cost plans. They're not extravagant plans, and they're not. The problem isn't that they're extravagant or that the benefit structure is so out of whack or terrible. But the issue is that, again, and now I've got to refer to the Senate bill. I mean, the president doesn't have a bill per se, of course.
Right.
So, the Senate health care reform bill would tax health plans that are worth more than, I believe, $8,500 for individuals, and I know for sure $23,000 per year for families. And there's strata to this. If workers are in high-risk occupations, or they're retired and 55 and older, they would tax plans more than $9,800, I think, for individuals, and something like $26,000 for families. So this would amount to an enormous tax on middle-class health benefits. So what the labor movement is saying is that a benefit tax is absolutely the wrong way to finance health care reform.
Well, you know what made me laugh, Larry? I don't know if you heard about this, but one of the concerns that with the excise tax, if you will, was that came up. I heard it tonight. It was that the wealthy is 1% or 10% or whatever that actually 1% that the that got the Bush tax cut back in 5 years ago or whenever it was. They said that they were concerned that those people would suffer unduly because they would be hit twice now because
they'd have the excise tax
on their benefits, and the Bush tax cut will no longer be in effect next year. So
this is terrible for them, right?
Terrible, yeah. I mean, do you realize that every member of Congress made over $90,000,
right,
with that one tax cut that year, okay, and of course every year since. That's how much they saved.
Right.
But
who was so concerned about this?
And does Congress allow? I mean, they have Cadillac plans.
Correct.
All right. Do they get taxed on those?
I would assume that absolutely. I mean, they wouldn't be exempt that effect, but they can also afford to.
Yeah, right.
But, we're seeing all kinds of numbers, but some of the numbers that are out there is that a benefit tax would hit nearly 20% of workers who have employer-provided health coverage. So that's quite a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And
I think if that health care bill goes through,
like, I want to make sure that your listeners understand that this benefits tax is going to hit more and more lower cost plans over time, and it's going to hit union and non-union plans. And again, it not only amounts to it's a middle class tax increase, and it would affect many plans that have high costs for reasons that have nothing to do with benefit levels, and that's just another kind of terrible irony of this whole thing. So the way we do oppose the excise tax, I mean, obviously we don't oppose health care reform. We all feel it's needed. Some unions, such as the machinist unions, have come out flatly against this now and have said that we can't support the bill in any way, shape, or form that has this tax on middle-class benefits.
unions, including our own AFSCME union, we haven't come out that strong. I mean, we absolutely oppose it. It's in every one of our, we're doing call-in days. In fact, tomorrow is a national call-in day. We have literature up on our website.
Yep.
We absolutely oppose an excise tax, but we're not prepared to employ an old cliche to throw the baby out with the bathwater and say the whole thing should be opposed.
But I think if that healthcare plan goes through with an excise tax, the union's not going to be able to turn out the rank and file to support the Democratic Party.
They're going to have huge problems. You're making a great point, which is how, and it's not just the unions. I mean, I think the members of Congress are going to have to be awfully nervous about where they go with this, because it is, as we all agree, you're talking about raising taxes you're raising revenue by taxing benefits of hardworking middle class people. John McCain said he would do that during the campaign.
That's right.
And we certainly mobilized against that. We think it's a bad idea. Again, I just don't know where this is going to end up, but it clearly it's a major concern for the labor movement. And all we can do at this point, and it's what we're trying to do, and I think we're doing a good job of it, is just mobilizing people to call in and make sure you call both Senators Dodd and Lieberman and call your state rep. Most of the listeners who live in Connecticut in your area, I believe, probably would be in the 5th Congressional District.
That's correct.
That would be Representative Murphy.
Chris Murphy.
And just hope that we can, the compromise that has to happen in the end, there has to be a reconciliation of the House and Senate bills. I mean, the good news is the House bill, with people like Connecticut's Joe Courtney at the helm trying to ride this through the process, the House bill does not have the excise tax. And the Senate bill, which does have the excise tax, passed. So those two bills have to be reconciled and a final product has to emerge. The reality check here is that if the president is supporting some kind of excise tax, that's going to be a problem.
Oh, it's going to be a huge problem.
But the other problem, or one of the other problems with the bill, and many problems that I can see, but one of the main, another big stumbling block is the Stupak bill, which got passed, which was the allowed government-paid abortions. All right, you're aware of that, right?
I wasn't.
Yeah, I saw him. I saw the C-SPAN thing with him last night, and on him, he was giving like a town meeting or something. But he was trying to explain that he wasn't really responsible for that bill. His bill was to avoid that whole thing and not. He's a pro-lifer and stuff. He didn't want abortion in there.
Right.
But what they did is they went to two different midnight committees on this thing, and wound up passing it at first. They didn't pass it, rather, at first by 29 votes. And then I believe it was Dorgan, if I'm not mistaken, Dorgan, who changed sides. And they did pass the House bill and named it the Stupak bill, but they included abortion.
Mm-hmm.
So that's going to be a huge stumbling block once it goes to the Senate, because it only passed by one vote.
Mm-hmm.
And then that was also, Senator Ben Nighthorse Campbell was the key player there in the Senate, actually, now that I think about that.
So it's a huge mess.
It's amazing how it's an important, volatile, emotional issue. I understand that, but, we have a Supreme Court decision called the Roe v. Wade.
I know.
Everything is in place to deal with that issue.
But it allows abortion for rape and incest and life of the mother.
Right. Right.
Right. But that's payable by federal dollars. But as far as voluntary abortion, no.
Yeah. But I wish that the fact that it just became embroiled in the Oval Office because it was a political, this is cynical politics.
Yeah, it is.
It's part of the weight dragging down when that becomes one of the many anchors dragging down. There's another potential anchor out there, which would be the insurance companies are lobbying for preemption language, meaning whatever emerges out of the federal legislative process would preempt anything that the states have. Connecticut insurers in particular desperately want that preemption language precisely because our union and others lobby for the Sustinet bill.
Right.
Lobby lobbied for the pooling, and even though Governor Rell vetoed the pooling bill, it's actually, pooling is going to be part of the recommendation in the implementation of the sustenance task force. Connecticut could actually end up being way ahead of the curve in terms of implementing its own health care reform that includes a public option, a cost-saving public option. So you could end up with preemption language that says the federal bill overrides anything that's created at the state level. And again, the big, powerful, rich insurance companies in Connecticut desperately want that exemption language in the federal bill because it will absolutely erase the work of what we're all doing in Connecticut. So, you know, this is going to be a quite an arduous, difficult, challenging, painful process. That's, I wish I could give you some
positive. Yeah, I mean, there's one other area, too, that Pelosi, you know, she claims that, I mean, in that bill, they also said that they had to, that either everybody's going to have to pay regardless if they can afford the thing, I guess, and if they don't pay for it, they're going to wind up going to jail and a stiff fine. Okay, if they don't pay for health insurance.
Right, and
I mean, what is she, nuts or what?
You know? Again, what we, just to be clear, I mean, what we, our union has lobbied for is not penalizing individuals.
Right.
The having corporations participate in pay or play. In other words, if you're not providing some level of decent benefits to your employees, then you would pay into a system that helps fund.
Right. That makes a lot of sense.
Right, and that's what we support, and now it's sort of transmogrified into something that penalizes individuals.
That was nuts. I mean, you know, jail time and fines if you can't. Hey, who the hell can afford $25,000, $30,000 to pay for their,
right.
They have to pay it out of pocket for a family coverage.
Right.
You can't. And then the other thing
is that the
insurance companies have been not preempted, but have been immune to the antitrust laws.
But Obama's supporting the change in that.
You're both right. You know, what's unacceptable is that the insurance industry is long, I think since
the 30s, or
Has been exempted from the antitrust laws, McCarran-Ferguson's name of the legislation, and that needs to be repealed. So, the House bill, thanks to the work of people like Congressman Joe Courtney, the House bill takes that exemption, that antitrust exemption, away from the industry, and they hate that. Believe me, the insurance industry does not want to have to play by the rules that everyone else plays by. But if I could, you know, ask a favor, which is we're talking about a lot of unpleasant possibilities.
Yeah.
We do have a national call-in day for health care reform tomorrow.
Oh.
And January 13th, and if your listeners would be, and you and Lila, if you could do this too, and Leo,
sure.
I'm going to give a number out. It's
yep.
Being coordinated through the AFL-CIO. It's a toll-free number. It's 877-323-5246. And just when the Capitol U.S. Congress switchboard answers, just ask for your representatives in Congress. If you don't know who they are, they'll help you when you tell them what your town and state are. And you'll get transferred over to, say, Chris Murphy's line, and you can just tell them to vote for a reform that doesn't tax health care benefits, that requires employers to pay their fair share, creates a public health insurance option, et cetera, et cetera. So that would be very helpful. So, again, it's 877-323-5246. We'll have that number momentarily on the council4.org website. But I think the best thing people can do, sometimes, you know, the best action you can take is the simplest and most direct one.
Mm-hmm.
And the more that our five members of Congress and our two senators hear from us about our concerns regarding health care reform, the better our chances are of emerging with a better bill and a fairer bill in the end. So that's, I'm doing it. What can I do that's simple, direct, and hopefully persuasive enough? And Chris Murphy's my congressman. I'm going to let him know where I stand, and if we all do that.
I'm going to shout there for just a second. I was looking at my switchboard here, and it turned out that it looked like the show stopped playing for a few seconds. It looks like there might have been some interference there. It's back on. It shows that I'm on live still. But prior, just a few seconds ago, if you're having difficulty or there was a dead silence there, it looks like I had an interference on the switchboard. Okay, so I apologize for that, and I'll go right back to the, there's about a few more minutes left.
Oh, I
I think so. One of the things that I wanted to mention is that in Connecticut, I was reading a month or so ago that to be able to afford a two-bedroom apartment, you have to make about $42,000 a year.
Imagine.
Can you imagine that? And so you're an ordinary person, working person. Maybe your combined income's of $42,000. How are you going to afford to pay for health insurance? You can't. If you don't get it from your
problem,
job.
That's right? That is the, you know, that you brought, make a great point. I mean, that cuts right to the issue of affordability. And that's why we need a system. I think you both know where I stand. It's, I would love to see something modeled along with the English have or the Canadians
have. Oh, I know,
have,
me too.
But something that's more uniquely American. I know it can be done and it ought to be done. And I'm not going to lose hope on that because I think in the end you have to have that kind of system to give everybody a level playing field because I know the report you're talking about or the news piece you're talking about, Lyle, and it, you know, it's even worse in areas like Fairfield County where you would have to earn something like $24 an hour wherever you live just to be able to afford to pay rent in a one-bedroom apartment.
Isn't that something?
No, the state is an impossibly expensive place
for
middle and lower class wage earners to live and raise their families. It's really tough here, and it's getting tougher with the economic downturn. So
we're close to the end of the show, but I wanted to ask you with Blumenthal getting Dodd's seat, who do you think will take his place?
Don't forget, there is an election. I'm kidding you, but
I know.
Talking about this thing being preordained for Blumenthal, but people shouldn't remember to vote.
He's gonna have a lot of competition. There's a lot of
certainly the early straw poll that Blumenthal.
He's a strong candidate, I think.
The only three names I've seen thus far on the Democratic side, you have the former Senator George Jepson from Stanford.
I liked him. He ran with Curry back in 2003.
Yes, he did. Curry was Senator.
I met him. We did a documentary. We were invited to film the entire 2002 State Democratic Convention. We were the only independent...
media.
The only independent produced company that was allowed to do that. And but we interviewed
him. He's a nice guy.
I liked him. I liked Jepson. I thought
he's former chair of the Connecticut Democrats.
Yeah, there was something about him that I liked. There was an integrity about him.
Well-spoken man. He appealed to both Leo and myself.
Yeah, we liked him.
We would wish that he was nominated for...
Yeah, over Curry.
Oh, we preferred him to Curry.
I mean, we knew Curry wasn't going to make it.
But
even against the corrupt governor, you know, we knew Curry didn't have a shot.
But anyway, that was
our personal choice.
Secretary of State Susan Bicewicz, was running for governor, dropped out of that, apparently, according to the news reports today, and will enter the attorney general's race instead. So right now you've got Bicewicz on the Democratic side, and I really haven't seen anybody firmly come out on the Republican side, but there is interest from Senator Andrew Rohrabeck from Goshen. Again, I think that...
Oh, man, are you serious?
I wish I were.
Oh, no, not Rohrabeck. Oh, God almighty.
He's going to run?
The Attorney General?
Let me not misstate anything. He is thinking of running according to...
Oh, make me gag. Oh, God. Okay, that's hysterical. Okay. But, I put everything I got behind Jepson on this one. everything in the universe.
No, I don't think all of that would make Attorney General, and that's how I feel.
God.
We'll have a better sense of this thing over the next couple of months. But again, I think it's going to be on balance. Blumenthal's those are very big shoes to fill. So we'll see what happens. Look, if it ends up being on the Democratic side, Jepson versus Bicewicz in the primary, that's going to be a fascinating race because she is a very tough and aggressive campaigner, and she's very committed to public service. So.
And she has her eye on something else. She wants to climb the ladder.
Yeah, well, she dropped out of the gubernatorial race, so maybe she does. This is...
Okay, nothing wrong with the tape. Must be a little loud. So. Bear with me, folks.
A positive he can take amid all the other.
And I hope they have some competition because I think that's important.
So far I really like Jepson.
That's who Leo's going to support. He's made up his mind already. He likes him before.
I've already made up my mind. I
to move forward.
Okay, I have no problem with that.
I don't know. I mean,
I
do like it much over. I mean, I actually Bicevitz scares the pants off of me, and I'll tell you why. Because she was the one that she was responsible for buying all of those e-voting machines that had no paper trails. Okay, remember that back in 2004?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, she
thought that was a bad decision.
I mean, that was insane. Okay, and I mean, that kind of thing going into an attorney generalship is more frightening than anything I can think of. You know, that somebody with that poor judgment.
I don't know the details behind
it. I know the details. I covered it, Larry. We covered it here on the show. I mean, for
some reason. Well, Larry has to look at it. You have to look back on it yourself, Larry.
Her and Dodd were involved with this, by the way, but she had a this HABA program.
Yeah.
But she had a complete meltdown there politically and whatnot. I mean, and she became a national a joke, okay, amongst the even in the news media, okay, for investing so much money in a non-paper trailed e-voting machines.
Right.
And she finally turned that around afterwards and
she managed to resurrect herself on that one.
Herself from it, but what a nightmare. I mean, that was a thing of judgment that just I wouldn't want.
A little bit scary.
I could never have that as a vote for that as an attorney general. Whoa.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I can't wait to talk to you guys again.
Let me just say that number one more time for people to call their congressman. It's 1-877-323-5246.
Perfect.
So please tell people how you're feeling about health reform.
Absolutely.
The things that you're against. Remember that you are against the taxation or the excise tax on health benefits. And anything else in that bill that upsets you and bothers you, that's why you have a congressman and why you have two senators. Tell them about it.
Yep.
Yeah.
Make your voice heard.
Okay, and Larry, thank you very much for being on.
Oh, boy, I love doing this. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you.
And we put you on the hot spot. I'm glad you could take it, Larry.
Guys are the best.
Yeah, we like it.
Thank you. We love you, too.
Thanks. Talk to you soon.
Bye-bye,
yeah.
Larry.
Good night, Larry.
Bye-bye.
That was Larry Dorman, political affairs coordinator for AFSCME Union, and he takes everything good-naturedly from us, which is very kind of him.
Well, I don't know.
Give him a little...
I think it's important that...
Have a little dialogue with him about stuff. He's a good guy.
Yeah, no, the Vicevitz thing is like, Vicevitz, that just scares the living hell out of me. And can you imagine Rohrbach as attorney? Oh my God, that's insane. Well, anyway, we'll go on from that next week. But thanks for everybody for joining us. Don't forget to, don't forget to tune in next week.
Yeah, thanks for being with us. Thanks, Lucy.
That's all right. Well, thanks so much. And, for listening. Join me tomorrow when we venture into the fourth dimension. And of course, I think we have George on Friday night. I have to check. But nevertheless, join me tomorrow night, Thursday night, right here. And same time, same place. And good night.